Dorothy, tell us about your typical day or maybe a typical week at Belanger Smith College.
Okay, well, my first, I actually took the bus from my hometown to Philander Smith College. It was about 300 miles. And, you know, nowadays the parents go and help the kids to get settled and everything. Actually, my parents never went to Philander Smith College. They never even went. Nobody went to help me get settled in my dorm or anything. I took the bus. I have a picture of myself standing beside the bus getting ready to go to Philander Smith College. And the first year, the first week of Philander Smith College was a lot of fun. I met all of these other black students. It was primarily black college, although we had a few foreign students and we had a few white students. But during that first week, we registered. We had lots of social occasions where we met the students, the other students who came from mostly Arkansas, all over Arkansas, but a few from other places as well, Michigan, Ohio. And then we had a chance. I remember that I walked around and I introduced myself. I would say, "Hello, I'm Dorothy Smith. How, you know, what's your name?" No, I wasn't Dorothy Smith then. I'm Dorothy White. I was Dorothy White then. And so I got up to one person. His name is Willie Toles. And he said, "What are you running for?" So that was fun. And then I have pictures. I have pictures of in our yearbook of us registering. And then during the first week, they would always have a freshman talent show. And all of the freshmen had to participate in the talent show. And so at the talent show, I recited from James Weldon Johnson's book, God's Trombones. I recited the creation. And so many people remembered me from that. In fact, my husband says he remembered me from that first night, because all of the upperclassmen would come to see what the freshman class would look like. And then after that, of course, we were all, after registration, we were all into our classes. We each took 15 units, and I had a very good experience. I figured out what my major would be.
What did you major in?
At first, I thought I would major in home economics, because during the first week, there were people, the teachers from each department would be recruiting people for their departments. So the home economics department was just really recruiting. And they saw me and they liked me and they thought I was so for, of course, as a freshman, you don't really declare your major yet. But I had thought that I would, but before the year was over, I decided that I wanted to major in English because that was really my best subject. And so I declared my major as English. However, in my second year, I became involved in with Carl, my husband, my current husband, whom I've been married to now for almost 56 years. And we married in 1958. But I was in the college choir. I was in the traveling college choir. And so we went on our spring trip to Ohio and Washington, D.C. and some other areas. And then when we came back home, you know, I got involved romantically and all of that, and so we went home for the summer, and when I came back in the fall, we eloped. Ooh. We got married. And
so you were still in school when you were married?
I did. I was. Uh-huh. But we did not tell anybody. We couldn't tell anybody because the rules of the school were that if you got married without telling the president that you were going to get married, that they would put you out of school. And we hadn't thought about that when we got married. So then after that, we had to do some maneuvering in order to try to convince them that, well, we wrote a letter. I got my mother to write a letter saying that they knew that we were married, although they didn't. I don't think my mother and father ever forgave me for that. But anyway, we married, and then in that next summer, the summer of 1959, my husband graduated from Philander Smith College. And so it was then that I left, you know, that I dropped out of school. And we moved to Cleveland, Ohio, where he went. And so after that, I did not return to college until 1963. And by then I had two children. And so when I returned to college, my youngest child was 18 months old. And when I went to college in Cleveland, the year that Cuyahoga Community College opened, which was 1963. So I went to the new Cuyahoga Community College for one semester, and then transferred from there to Western Reserve University. And it is now Case Western Reserve right. University. But then it was Western Reserve University, and Case Institute of Technology was across the street. And so they have since merged, and it's now Case Western Reserve. But I graduated magna cum laude from Case Western Reserve University in 1966. And when I graduated, I have a picture of myself with my two children trying on my graduation cap. But anyway, I encountered very, very few black students at Western Reserve University. I was the only black student in almost all of my classes. I was into my major. I was in the junior and senior year, and I was in classrooms where sometimes the white teachers, would talk openly about black people, you know, as if I weren't even in the classroom. But I would always challenge them. One day, one of my English teachers said, present company accepted. He said something about black people and then said, present company accepted. And so I sat up and I said, are you talking about me? Am I the present company? So I was actually a fighter, you know. And so I challenged him. I don't really remember what his answer was. He just went on to another subject area. But even at Cuyahoga Community College, there was a teacher who had looked at me on the first day as she was supposedly talking to all of the students. And she said, now, if you don't want to work, if you are not did not come in here to work, then you might as well just drop the class right now, she said, looking directly at me. But then after I turned in my first paper, she had to hold up my paper and use my paper as an example of the way a paper should be written. But I had very high esteem. I had been taught by my parents from a very early age, you can be anything that you want to. You are smart as or smarter than anybody else. There are going to be people out there who will say negative things about you, because, of course, we were growing up in a segregated society. So our parents had to prepare us for what we were going to face. And they said, when people say something negative about you, you just let the water roll off you like water off a duck's back, and you are going to be all right. And in fact, I have since written some poems about my mother's advice to me, and that was some of that advice was what I had just stated. And so when I arrived in arriving in Cleveland, Ohio, it was the first time I ever really felt discrimination. Now that's very ironic, isn't it? because I had grown up in Tennessee in a segregated environment. But I realized that I was in a very protective environment. I had gone from Tennessee to, I realized, of course, there was segregation and discrimination, and I couldn't go to the local college and all of that. But then I went to Philander Smith College, where all of the professors and the students and the president embraced me. The president of Philander Smith College had, had named me one of the ambassadors for the school, and anytime any dignitaries would come to the campus, then I was one of the people who greeted them and that kind of thing. And so I was embraced and loved, and then I went to Western Reserve University. I went to Cleveland, and that's when I really started feeling the discrimination, you know, from my teachers in the classrooms. I had had white teachers at Philander Smith College, but they were teachers who wanted to be there, who wanted to work with black students. But then when I went to Western Reserve University and Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, I encountered teachers who had apparently not had very many black students, obviously didn't like black students, obviously didn't believe that black students could learn, didn't have high expectations of black students, and this was supposedly in the North, or the Midwest, or wherever. And so it was the first time in my life that I had ever heard the words culturally deprived.
What year was this?
This was 1959 when we moved to Cleveland, and it was 1963-64 when I started back to school. But during this period, during this period in Cleveland, we had street clubs. It was when black and white people were trying to get to know each other better, and so we had street clubs.
What street clubs?
Our street club was the Lynn Street. We lived on Lynn Street. So we had the Lynn Street Street Club in Cleveland. In fact, my husband was more involved in the street club than I was. And the black and white people would get together to talk, you know, to try to get to know each other. And then I would hear these things, and when I heard the words culturally deprived, I said, well, what do you mean by culturally deprived? And what they meant was, black people had been deprived of the opportunity to have the same culture as white people. And so therefore we were culturally deprived. So I said, well, I don't feel culturally deprived. My culture, I'm proud of my black culture. I had grown up with my black culture. I had been always taught that my culture was very rich. I knew black history, which I had learned both in high school and in Philander Smith College. And so those words were very, very foreign and very, very disturbing to me. But then I began to see how black people were being stereotyped, and black children were being stereotyped in these larger black urban cities like Cleveland. But well, I received my teaching credential at Western Reserve University, and then I taught at Glenville High School in Cleveland. That was my first teaching assignment. I had done my student teaching at Glenville High School from 1965 to 66. And then I accepted my first teaching job from 1966 to 67. And guess my salary was $5,500 for the year. $5,500 for the whole year. I still have a copy of that salary contract for the entire year. So that just shows you, and that was pretty average back in 1966 when I got my first professional job.
What was the student population like as far as racial?
At Glenville High School, where I worked, where I taught, it was virtually all black school. Okay. There were a few white students there. There were, I suppose, we probably had about 10% white students and 90% black students at Glenville High School. And so I had gotten to know the students. Actually, there's a person here in San Diego whom you might know. He has worked as an assistant to several political figures. His name is Eric Herford. And Eric was a student at Glenville High School. I met him in 1965 and 1966 at Glenville High School. And I lived in the neighborhood. Most of the teachers lived in the neighborhood. There were white and black teachers, so most of the students were black. And so that was a good year. I remember many things, but of course that's not the focus of this that's not the focus of this interview. It would take me forever to tell you about all of those experiences. But one of the things that I know you wanted to know was, what was my first job? My first job was actually in Martin, Tennessee, when I was around 12 years old. And and I cleaned houses. I was hired to clean houses a couple times a week for white families. And so I would clean the houses, and then I would also take in ironing. I ironed for people. They would iron by the piece. They would pay me so much
old?
For each piece. Yes, 12 when I was
Amazing.
12, 13. And through high school, actually 12, 13, 14, I worked cleaning people's houses. And of course, when I was very early between the ages of before I was 10 years old, I would go to the cotton patch in Tennessee. And then one of the things that I should have told you about the segregated environment in Martin, Tennessee, was that we would have our school year based on the cotton chopping and cotton picking time. And so whereas the white students would go back to school in September, and they would end the school in June, our school year, we would have the break. Our school would end in May, and then there was the time when the students and their whole families would go to work in the fields, and that would be when the chopping cotton, chopping other kinds of things. And so from June through September, we would be out of school. I don't know. I don't remember exactly which months they were, but I know that during the summer, there would be time for work. There would almost be a normal summer. but then we would start back to school early and go to school from, I believe it was July through September. And then we would be out of school for a couple of months in October and November, because that was the time when entire families would go, black families, would go to the cotton fields to pick cotton, because that's the way many black people earned their money for the whole year. The whole family would go. Whereas the white students would be back in school. They'd have a regular September through June year. But our year would be broken up based on when we were needed for the agricultural work. And it actually worked out all right for both the black and white families, but there were many students who would even stay out longer than the other students so that they would work to help to raise money for their families, and because that's when the white farm owners needed black people to pick cotton. And so...
Was this sort of like sharecropping? or it wasn't sharecropping?
No, it wasn't sharecropping. They would just pay so much per pound for the cotton that we picked.
Okay.
And so the whole family, so in the morning, the nice thing would be that our teachers would go to the cotton field too to make extra money. Mr. Connor, my favorite teacher who taught the algebra and the history and the biology, he would go, he would be on the, we'd get on the back of the truck, of course, and he would go to the cotton fields too. So he made extra money too. And then in the summer, those months of July and August and September, when we were out of school, Mr. Connor would also work on the train. So the teachers didn't make much money, and they would also go. He would work on the a particular train line all summer as a porter, and in order to make extra money for his family. So that was all very very interesting. And
and what exactly would porters do?
You know, they cooked, they greeted
they
people,
served dinner.
Yes, and so our teacher did that. Mr. Connor especially was the one who would do that in the summertime, and then he would go to the cotton field with the students during the time we were all out of school.
They would take the luggage from the guests, and
yes,
they,
yes,
boarded the train.
Right, absolutely. And so, so as I indicated at Glenville, this is when I felt, I mean, not at Glenville, but in Cleveland, was when I really felt the discrimination that was in the country. Ironically, you might have thought that I would have felt it more growing up in the South, but we were very much protected by our families and nurtured by our teachers. And so actually, we just didn't even think about the white people. We just went ahead and did our work, and we felt loved. And but when I got out there into the world, then I realized about the how discrimination was working in the world when I got into a university where there were white people, where there were white teachers. And those experiences that I had with white teachers were much different from the experiences I had had with my black teachers who loved and nurtured me. And so
you taught at Glenville for
Glenville
1 year.
High School. I taught at Glenville for 1 year. And then after that 1 year, we moved to California.
So you moved to California in 1967.
1967. Mm-hmm. I taught at Glenville from 1966 to 67, and then we moved to California. And the reason that we moved to California was that my husband had an allergy, hay fever, and he suffered so much back in that part of the country. So I looked at him one day and I said, well, why do we have to live here? Why don't we just go and live somewhere else? And so I did the research and found that either California or Arizona would be places to live where he would not suffer so much with his allergy. And so after we decided that it would be either California or Arizona, then we searched for jobs. Well, as a teacher at that time, I knew that I would be able to teach, or felt that I would be able to teach wherever I went. And he said, well, if I look for the Veterans Administration hospitals, they are all over the country, so we'll see where there are jobs in my field, which is social work. He was a social worker. So he looked for jobs in social work at the various VA hospitals, and there was an opening, one in Arizona, in a small city in Arizona, and one in Long Beach. And I said, I think that Long Beach would be the better place for the children to grow up. And so we got in the car, we packed up, we gave away all of our furniture that we had. We were renting, so we didn't have, you know, we didn't have a house, but we had furniture. We had some beautiful furniture. And in fact, we bought this furniture. We brought this furniture with us to California.
Oh, this beautiful.
This sofa
Since 1967?
This sofa we bought in 1961, used, for $50 in Cleveland. We got it at a garage sale or something. And then this table, and then there were two tables that matched this. I've since given those away, and I purchased these two since I've been here. These lamps.
Oh.
We've had since 1961, and so this table,
beautiful.
This sofa, those lamps. And that table, that table over there. But that table is one of those that folds down. It's one of those
right. the leaves, drops.
Right. It's a drop leaf, mm-hmm. right. And so we bought that one also. It only had two chairs then, though. And I have since collected the other chairs. You'll notice they're not all alike. But when you first look at them, because I had them painted all alike, you would think that they all
yes.
came as a set. But they didn't. They're actually three different sets of chairs around that table. But anyway, we brought those. There were certain things we could not bring. The heavy pieces we gave away. There was one really beautiful cabinet a book cabinet that I wanted that's actually bigger than that piano over there, and it was so heavy that we couldn't bring it. But so we gave all of the things that we couldn't bring to our neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and we brought these pieces that we that we could. And so we've lived with all these. So my opinion is, if you buy something and you keep it long enough, it'll become an antique.
Correct.
So we moved to Long Beach, and then I taught. First of all, I found out that it wasn't easy for me to just teach right away in California. When I first came to California, they had passed a law that teachers had to have a fifth year of anything. You had to take a fifth year of education.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't have the reciprocity at that time. Because even now if you get a teaching credential in Ohio, then you can come to California and you can teach. But at that time, they didn't have that reciprocity arrangement. And so they told me that I would have to have another year of education of anything. They didn't specify what it had to be in, because I already had the teaching credential. And so I said, well, if I'm going to have to go to school for another year, just take anything, then I'll just go and get my master's degree. So I enrolled at Long Beach State University, California State University at Long Beach. And in 1 year, I received my master's degree. So I was able to write my, the thesis and take the... I remember that I did have to take French, because I did not... I had taken one French course at Western Reserve University, but I took another French course as a part of that year during my master's, and I received my master's degree. I just went to... California State University in Long Beach for a full year, and by May, June, I had my master's degree. So we moved to Long Beach in June of 1967, and by 1968, we moved there in June of 1967. I didn't go to school immediately. I started to school... I must have received my master's in 69. So I started to school in 68, and then I received the master's degree in 69. But I do know that it took me 1 year. And so we were still, after that 1 year, then I received, I taught high school in Long Beach for 1 year. I taught at Millikan High School in Long Beach, and at the end of that year...
Millikan,
M-I-L-L-I-K-A-N, Millikan High School. At the end of that year, they had a budget shortage, And so I received a letter from them that I might not have a job, you know, that they could probably not rehire me in September. And so I thought, okay, well, I have to get a job, so I want to get a job. We want to buy a house, so therefore I said, okay, I will go to the community colleges and apply for a job. Well, you know, I applied for a job at the community college, and then I received a letter saying, in fact, I still have that letter. It said, in effect, we know that we sent you that letter, but we didn't mean you, because you have some special needs that we need, which meant I was black. So they needed, but well, then why didn't they tell me then? Why did they send me that letter? So I didn't trust that. I wasn't going to sit around and wait until September and find out I didn't have a job. So I went and applied for the job. I was accepted at Long Beach City College. And then the Unified School District, Long Beach Unified School District, protested that. They asked the board, the community college board, not to hire me because they wanted to use me. So it was a back and forth. And finally, I did, I got the teachers union involved. And I was able to go to Long Beach City College. So that was the situation in which they sent me the letter firing me, actually, in effect. Then when I tried to get another job, they said no, they didn't intend to fire me, they wanted me. And I had to fight in order to get the new job. And so the board approved my going to San Diego, to Long Beach City College. Well, the problem was, at that time, all of the boards, the board of Unified School District in Long Beach and the board of the Community College District in Long Beach were the same board. So it was the same board that had to approve my going to the Community College District. But anyway, it worked out. So we settled down in Long Beach. Long Beach was a lovely little city. My children started school school. There were little white children who tried to be nice to my son.
How old were your children at that time?
My son was 8, and my daughter was 5, almost 5. And so my son started school that year, and I think my daughter went to school for the first time the next year. But when my son went to school, he came home and he says, "The little girl said that her mother's best friend is black." Because they were the only black children in the school. And I need to tell you about that part too. They were the only black children in the school, and so all of the little white children some of the little white children were trying to be nice to them. And so when this child said to him, "My mother's best friend is black," and he says, "My mother's best friend is black too." So he didn't know how funny that was when he got home and told us, and we laughed about it. But the way that we got into that neighborhood was that before we left Cleveland, we also knew that we had to find a place to live in Long Beach. And so what we did was, that was just the very beginning of the fair housing law in California. I believe it was passed in 1967. I know it was around that time. It was either 1966 or 1967. And so we were among the very first people, black people, who benefited from the fair housing law. So we wrote, I had heard about this fair housing, and so I wrote to the Fair Housing Council in Long Beach, and they arranged, they found a home for us to rent in Long Beach. When we got there, there were some people who were still living in the home, and it wasn't available for a while. But we got to know the people who lived in the home. They were black people, too. So it must have started in 1966. Those black people had been placed in that particular home. The homes that were designated for, that owners had designated could be rented to black people. And so the couple and their child that lived there were the Stringfellows. And so while we were waiting for that house to become available, we rented another place. But anyway, we, just for a very short time, actually, my brother found a place for us to live in Compton. He lived in Compton, California. And so we lived there until this home became available. And then we moved. So it was under the aegis of the fair housing policy that had been recently passed in California that we were able to move into our first house in that neighborhood. And so we were the only black people in the whole neighborhood. The other family that moved out moved to another, they bought a house somewhere else. And so so that my children then experienced this. So when my daughter went to school on her first day, she sneezed. And a little girl looked at her and said, "Oh, is that how black folks sneeze?" And there were, the children really experienced discrimination in Long Beach because the policemen would even pass by. My son would be walking down the street and they would say, the policeman would holler out something about pork chops to the child, you know. And so, but the neighbors were nice. You know, we had a very, very friendly neighborhood, all got together for parties and that kind of thing. So the people in the neighborhood were very nice. But it was that area in Long Beach where we lived was, we purchased, that was in 1967. Well, in 1970, we purchased our home. We purchased our first home in Long Beach. And it's still in it's a very nice area of Long Beach. It's right across it's right near the largest park in Long Beach. And so whenever we go back to Long Beach, we go back and we stop by and see our neighbors and we see our old house and we still have neighbors there that we knew that we go and see. But we have the only children in school in the neighborhood, but there were some other black adults who lived in the neighborhood. And one of them became our best friend, and she actually still lives on that street in that same neighborhood. But our children were the only children in the school. And my daughter remembers some very traumatic times there. For instance, the teachers, they would do the square dancing or other dancing, and the parents would write to the school and say to the teacher, my child cannot hold hands with the black child. Do not let my black." And so you know what the teacher did, rather than use that as a teachable moment? The teacher actually had my child sit down and not even participate in the dance classes, lessons, because the white children didn't want to hold her hand. And my daughter remembers, that there would always be two lines. Three lines. One line with all the white girls, and one line with all the white boys, and then a line with her in it. So she had some very traumatic experiences there at that school. And actually, there are many of those things that she doesn't even remember. She says she remembers going to the school. She remembers the crossing guard was nice, but actually some of those years that she was there in that Long Beach school, she can't even remember what happened mostly at the school except the traumatic experiences. So it was a very traumatic experience. But my son, on the other hand, he decided that he would fight. He said... he you know, that they, when they said things to him and did things to him, he would just start fighting. So therefore, so the teachers would call and say he got in a fight. So we had to go to school and find out what was going on. And then they found out that he was a good athlete. So then they wanted to choose him for their teams. So that's how he got over during those years. But both of the children really had some terrible experiences, especially my daughter. So they were happy when we moved to Long Beach. Now both of my children are fine now. You know, it didn't.
How long were you in Long Beach?
We were in Long Beach from 67 to 73. 6 years. 6 years. But so when we moved to San Diego in 1973, the children, my son went to Horace Mann High School. He was 12. Did you go to Horace Mann too? But anyway, my son went to Horace Mann, and my daughter went to Oak Park. She was, when we came here, she was in fourth grade, so she spent her fifth grade year at Oak Park. Her children also attended Oak Park.
Oh, yeah.
And her children, who are now 21 years old, recently returned during the summer, and they went over to visit their old teachers who are still, a couple of them are still at Oak Park. So that it was at Oak Park Elementary School that my daughter had her first, Oak Park here in San Diego, that my daughter had her first black teacher. And so seeing the education of my own children and seeing the education of myself, I was in an all segregated environment, black. They were in a segregated environment, white, and they were the only black children. And so their experience in school was not nearly as pleasant as my experience had been when I was their age. So then they went from, that was 1973. So now I have to tell you about my experience, and I'm not getting very far down this list. You might have to have a second interview with me,
and that would be fine,
to get to all of this. But when I came to San Diego, I worked full time at Long Beach City College. I was teaching English at Long Beach City College. And when I got ready to come, when my husband actually came down to San Diego before me, he came down to work at the new VA hospital in San Diego. Well, I really didn't want to move. I was all settled. We had bought a new house. I mean, we had bought a house. And I had a job that I liked. And so I didn't move right away. He came down to work at the VA hospital. And during that year, I stayed and continued to work, and then sold our house in Long Beach. Meanwhile, we looked for a house down here. And this is the house that we bought. We've lived in this house for 41 years now. This is the house that we purchased when we came to San Diego. So I would come down to San Diego and look for help my husband to look for houses. At the same time, I sold my house. I didn't get a realtor because we had just purchased the house, 3 years before. So I developed the contract and went to the bank and helped to get the loan for the new people who were interested in moving in the house. And I just did it all myself and wrote up the contract myself and sold the house in Long Beach. And then we moved down here in February of, my husband was already down here, not in the house yet, but he was down here and he was renting from some people that we know. In fact, that's how we got to know the DeWitt family, Rufus and Mary DeWitt. He lived at their house for a while, and then they found a place for friends of theirs that he could rent from until I could move down here. And so I moved to San Diego in 1973. Actually, when I moved here, I already had not a contract, but I already had arrangements for a part-time job at San Diego City College. People were very, very nice to me in Long Beach. I actually, when I got ready to move down here, I actually sent a letter of resignation to Long Beach City College. And the president of Long Beach City College, the president of Long Beach City College called me and asked me to come in. And
I'm sorry, the camera or the SD card can pull, there's only 5 minutes left on it, so I have to switch the thing on. That's why I was trying to tap you. I'm sorry, I ruined
that's,
it.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have another one?
Yeah, there's another one. Yeah, this one.
You want some water, some juice?
Maybe use the restroom?
Oh. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I should have shown you where that was before.
I'm gonna just get some water.
I apologize for interrupting.
Oh, no.
That's
fine.
No,
that'll give me time to check my messages and stuff. And give you the stretch.
You go straight back.
And I'm quiet.
Live in 3, 2, 1.
So actually, when we came to San Diego, I had already made arrangements for a job at San Diego City College. I also wanted to let you know that when I actually wrote a letter of resignation to the president of Long Beach City College, the president called me and asked me to come in to talk to him. And he said, "Don't resign." He said, "I received your letter of resignation, but I don't want you to resign." He said, "You can actually take a leave." He said, "You can take a leave for 3 years." He said, "You might get down to Long Beach and decide you don't want, I mean, down to San Diego and decide you don't want to be there." And he said, "So you could actually come back to Long Beach City College and work." It was very, very nice. His name was Dr. Wiley Garner. He was president of Long Beach City College. And he was the one who gave me the name of Reverend George Walker Smith. He said, there is a member of the school board down there. His name is Reverend George Walker Smith. And he said, this is his information. He said, "I want you to call him, talk to him." He said, "He will help you to find a job in Long Beach, in San Diego." And that's how I met Reverend Smith. Reverend Smith has helped just about every black person who came to San Diego to get a job in San Diego, whether it was in the schools or elsewhere, because of his connections. And so he, among all of the people, I think, has been the most important in helping black people to get jobs and to get started in San Diego. And so I called Reverend Smith, and he told me places that I could apply. I actually applied to San Diego Unified, and I also, in the meantime, since we moved in the middle of the year, I applied for positions at San Diego City College. And so they had some classes at San Diego City College where I could teach. So I started teaching part-time at San Diego City College. I think I taught two classes. And then I also applied to Grossmont College. And I taught a class or two at Grossmont College as well. I don't think I taught that very first semester in 73, because we didn't move down here until February and school was already in session. But I did teach in the fall of 73. In the fall of 73, I started teaching at San Diego City College part-time and at Grossmont College part-time. Now, in the spring of 74, there was a position at Grossmont College, a full-time position at Grossmont College. Actually, it was one of the Grossmont English teachers was on leave, and so I applied for a position at Grossmont College. I was actually accepted for the position at Grossmont College by the president. But then the English department at Grossmont College rebelled because they said that they had some part-time teachers at Grossmont College, and those teachers should have been the ones who got the jobs. Now, I don't know whether those teachers had applied for the job or not. But for a whole semester, for that whole semester of spring of 1973, and I'm getting my dates a little. I need to really look back to see the specific dates. But I know that it was the summer. It was must have been the summer of 1973 when I applied for the job at Grossmont College. At that point, I had been teaching part-time at San Diego City College. And I had also taught a class part-time at Grossmont College. But then there were positions that I applied for, full-time positions, at both San Diego City College and Grossmont College. And I actually received a contract for the position at San Diego City College. That must have been the fall of 73. And it was in the summer of 73 that I had applied for the position at Grossmont College. And the teachers in the English department didn't want me. They didn't want me to have the position, even though I had taught an English class at Grossmont College that same semester. They had two people that were their favorite part-time people, and they wanted those people to have the job. So you know what happened? I started teaching full-time at San Diego City College in the fall of 1973. I had a contract. Grossmont College, I just decided that I would let Grossmont College do its racist thing. And so Grossmont College took that position that was supposed to be a full-time position for one person, which the president of Grossmont College had approved for me, and they divided that position up. It was a full-time position. They divided the position up among four people. So they gave me a 25% contract for that fall. Well, that was all right with me because I was teaching full-time at San Diego City College. And then I got an additional 25% contract at Grossmont College. So that was just fine with me. Well, Grossmont College was so isolated that they could not even call San Diego City College to find out that I was working already at San Diego City College, and I didn't tell them because they were being so mean. Well, so all during that semester when I was already teaching full-time at San Diego City College with a 25% contract at Grossmont College, one of the instructors at Grossmont College in the English department decided, well, I'm going to take a semester break. And then, when I take that semester break, then you can offer Dorothy Smith that contract for one semester at Grossmont College. That would have been the spring of 1974. So, when they were so mean that they offered me a contract to teach four courses. The first course would have been at 8 o'clock in the morning. The last course, the schedule that they gave me, the last course started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I would have had to be at Grossmont College all day, you know, on that. And it was just mean, rather than to try to put my classes together, maybe give me a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or and have me not teach class, but they had me down for courses every day, starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, and maybe I wouldn't even have a class during the day, but the last one would be at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I wrote them a letter. I still have all of these letters that I wrote back and forth. I wrote them a letter saying, I rejected. I rejected their contract. I said, I will not accept your contract for the spring of 1974. Oh, they were all up in arms. What? You will not accept my contract? I indicated in my letter, I have already accepted a contract at another college in the area. Then they wanted to know, they would come in the, when I would go in the restroom, they would come in the restroom and say, well, what college would you, you mean that you would accept another college and not Grossmont College? I said, I will not accept your one semester contract, especially since they had written to the president that they would accept me as an affirmative action candidate. That's what they said. And so, of course, I have the letter showing them I'm more qualified than any of the other people who have applied for the position. And I would be in the meetings when they were trying to plan all of this. Since I was already in the English department, I would be in their meetings. And then I would ask questions, just as I did when that professor at Western Reserve said, present company accepted.
Right.
I spoke up, so when they started talking, I said, well, how did each one of you, I turned to the other part-time people, and I said, how did you get your job? And then I turned to the full-time people. I said, well, how did you get your job in the English department at Grossmont College? Every one of them got the job because they knew somebody. They said, well, he told me about the job, he told me about the job. Well, so I just decided I would play along with them. And then the president wrote, I still have his note too. The president wrote to me and he said, would you please state to me the real reason that you have rejected the contract that was offered you for next semester? And I told them, I'm looking for a job that's permanent. I'm not interested in your one semester contract job that has me starting to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and ends up at 5 o'clock in the evening every day. And so I reject it. I deserve more. I'm qualified, more qualified than any of the other candidates that have applied, in my opinion, and I will not accept that position. And so then one person said, why would you accept a position at another place in San Diego? Okay. And where is it that you are working? And where is it that you've accepted the contract for? But I left Grossmont College at the end of that semester, 1973. And later, many of the people from Grossmont College said, we really made a big mistake by not, especially after I became a member of the school board in San Diego. They wanted to, you know, they said, oh, we just really made a mistake because I was in the paper. Oh, there were so many articles about me mm-hmm. in the paper because when I became in 1981, I had been very involved in the organizations and especially advocating for education of children in San Diego. And I was a member of the YMCA, I was a member of Women Incorporated, I was very active with the Urban League and their education activities, and I was just very involved. And so Joe Littlejohn had been, after Reverend Smith had served on the school board for 16 years, Joe Littlejohn was elected to the District E seat on the school board following Reverend Smith. And after he had been on the board for a year and a half, he was offered a position as municipal judge in San Diego. He's an attorney who had worked as an attorney for the school district. And so he accepted the judgeship and resigned his position on the school board. And when he resigned his position on the school board, people started calling me and asking me if I would seek the appointment on the school board. And so I said to my husband, I said, you know, it's so silly. People are calling me, asking me to seek an appointment on the school board appointment. And he said, well, you're always out there working for education anyway. He said, you might as well be in a position where you could really do something. And so I thought about that, and I thought, well, okay. You know, I found out what it was going to take in order for me to to apply for the position. There were 15 mostly black people who applied for the position. And the way that they had it set up was that in May of 1981, we would have to go before the school board and speak for a certain number of minutes, just stating our position and why we wanted to become a member of the school board. And then they would select 4 people who would come back about a month later, and they would interview those 4, and then the school board would decide who would be appointed. And so I was selected as one of the 4 people, the 4 finalists. And then when I went back, after being questioned for 15 minutes, they questioned each person for 15 minutes, and the school board selected me as the one who was appointed. Is my husband still in the kitchen? Okay. But anyway, sorry. I'm sorry for that. But anyway, I was appointed to the school board. Now, that was in May of 1981. But the rule was, if you are appointed to the school board, then you have to run for office. You have to actually file for election a few years later. I mean, not
because that's not
later.
An elected position.
No, it was appointed. It's an elected position. And so they appointed me. And then in September, it was the election. So all of a sudden, what I thought was simple, okay, I'll get the appointment. All of a sudden, I realized I had to run for election. And so I had to run for the primary election in September. And then
that was 1981?
That was 1981. And then I had to run for the general election in November. So at that time, the primary is now in June, but at that time it was in September. And so I ran for, so I had to get together a committee. I had to raise money. I had to do all of those things that I had never done before in my life. And the person who encouraged me to run was, the first encouraged me to run was Thelma Pryor. She's now deceased. But her husband had been the assistant to Mayor Pete Wilson. When Mayor Pete Wilson was the mayor of San Diego, Thelma's husband had been his assistant. And so she was very active in the community also. And so she helped. She became the chairperson of my committee.
Is she black?
Yes. And Reverend Smith served on the committee, and Reverend Smith got some of his other people to serve on the committee, and so I was one of 3 finalists. There were 2 Hispanic people who were also on the ballot, and so there were 3 of us, and I was one of the 2 finalists. The Mario Palomino was the other one who made it to the finals. And then in November, of course, I was elected. I was elected to the school board. Now then, in 1983...
San Diego's
San Diego Unified School District Board of Education. The San Diego Unified School District Board of Education. And then at that point, we were elected in an off year. But then they changed it so that we would be elected. The next election then was in 83. It was still an off year election. 83, 80, 81, 83, 85. And so I had to run again 2 years later for re-election. And I was re-elected by 80% of the vote in 1983. Well, then at 1983, then they changed so that the elections would be in 84 at the same time as the presidential elections. And that's the way it's been ever since. But I served on...
Did you have to run again in 84?
No, because I had been elected in 83. And so it would be at least 4 years then before I would have to run again. And I decided not to run again. I announced before that next election that I wasn't going to run again. And so during that that political life.
Yeah, what were some of the highlights during your, you had 7 years?
Yeah, seven and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
7.5 years.
What were some of the major changes within this San Diego Unified School District during your tenure on the board?
Well, when I arrived on the board, it was a time when the integration had started. There were steps toward integration that had started in San Diego, and actually there was a suit against the San Diego Unified School District. You might have been the Carlin desegregation case, and so there had already been some attempts to desegregate, and I say desegregate rather than integrate, because what was happening was they would bus black students to white schools, but then they would keep them segregated within the schools. They would bus them to the school, they would count them as being on campus, but they would actually have them all in segregated classrooms. They were black students who would still be in classrooms with only black students. And so they were doing that. So that was one thing I noticed. Another thing is, on the day that I began on the school board, that was the day that the big testing scandal, there was the announcement that there was a big testing scandal where the teachers had changed grades on the tests and that kind of thing. So I hit the ground running. Now, my first day of the school board, that was the big news.
That was 1917?
81.
81, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was the integration. There was the VEEP, the Volunteer Ethnic Enrollment Program. That was the busing program where any student could go to any school that was participating in the VEEP, Voluntary Ethnic Enrollment Program. And but what was happening to them was that the people at the schools, or for instance at Lewis Junior High School, they would be throwing rocks at the buses and all. They didn't want the children to be coming into black children to be coming into their neighborhood, so it wasn't good.
It was just the one way blacks going into the white schools. It wasn't the white.
Right. Well, then shortly afterward, they started the magnet school program, where they would develop special programs in the schools in the black areas. But then when the white students would come, then they would separate the whites also, just the same way they were separating the black students at the white schools. They would separate the white students at the black schools. For instance, at Gumpers Secondary, there was the Gumpers Magnet Program. And the white students were promised that if they came to the school, they wouldn't have to be in the classroom with black students. Mm-hmm. And that's actually, they actually built fences around the places where the white students were in the magnet schools, magnet programs. And they let a few black students get in there, but they were mostly white students who came to those schools. They counted them as a part of the school, but they were actually still in the segregated, they were segregated from the black students at those schools. And the parents would say, they would come down to the board and say, when I went to that school, I was promised that my child would not have to be in a class with black students. And so you had all of that that was happening. You also had counselors. At that time, the main goal of educating black students was to get them out of high school. It was not to get them into college. And so that was what I was confronting as a board member. So I decided that my goal would be to provide equity in education for all students and opportunities for the highest quality of education for all students. And that would mean that that black children would be able to take advantage of the gifted programs, which there were people who were saying then, teachers who said there was no such thing as a black gifted child. The counselors were telling black students that they should not even think about four-year universities, and this was the majority of counselors. They said you should just consider going to a community college. The black parents would try to get their students in the college preparatory courses. But the black students and white students would actually get separate kinds of information. For instance, the white students who were in college prep classes would get all of the information about the graduation requirements and the SAT and the all of the tests that they were supposed to take, and they would not even announce those in the classrooms where the majority of the black students were. And I even had an experience with my own child who graduated from high school in 1980. She came home one day and told me that her counselor had told her, now she was a sophomore, and she came home and said her counselor had told her that this was a little before I became a member of the school board, because she graduated in 1980 and went to college and graduated from college in 84. But she said, my counselor told me I don't have to take any more classes because I have already fulfilled my high school requirements. And I said, I am not concerned about what you need to get out of high school. I'm concerned about what you need to get into college. And so I went over to the school, of course, and I told them she has not taken, I told them all the courses that she had not taken yet. They said that she could go and get a job or something. And she was just in 10th grade because she had not taken the courses that I felt that she needed to take, and she didn't. She didn't have the courses that she needed to have in order to get into any decent college. And so this is what most black children were doing. If the counselors looked at black children, they simply decided, well, you're going to take these classes to get out of high school, but they didn't even tell them about what courses they needed to take to get into college or what other requirements they were. So I knew that when I got onto the board, I knew that there was something that I had to do about that. So when I became a member of the board, I found that, a member of the Board of Education, I found that most black students, almost all black students, were programmed only into classes to get out of high school. Very, very few of them were programmed into a schedule, a curriculum that would enable them to get into college.
So no college prep classes.
No college prep classes for them. And in fact, they had special classes that they would put them in. Now, for instance, they would say, okay, well, you need 3 math classes in order to graduate from high school. You know what those classes were? Not a single one of them was a college prep course. It was in ninth grade, it was career English or career math. In ninth grade it was consumer math. In 10th grade it was called career math. And in 11th grade it was called developmental math. And all of those courses were only 7th and 8th grade math. Not a single one was algebra. Not a single one was, you know, after the developmental, then I think by 12th grade, if these students wanted to take another course, they would put them in something called pre-algebra in the 12th grade, which white students were taking in the 7th grade. And so I introduced you might hear about the Common Core curriculum now. Well, in 1987, I introduced the Common Core curriculum policy. And it was that all students would have to take algebra, biology, chemistry, you know, they would all, and we got rid of, that's when we got rid of those 3 classes that they were putting all the black students into. So consumer math, career math, and developmental math. My proposal that I presented to the board got rid of all of those courses. But what had happened is, slowly over the years, they did not follow. After I left the board, they didn't follow that plan. The plan was piloted. It was approved by the board. It was piloted by Bertha Pendleton, who was then the deputy superintendent. She was the one who led the pilot, and it was approved to be implemented throughout the school district. Well, there were some of the administrators down at the district and the math teachers in the schools fought it. And so over the years, these courses did become available to more students, but they were not required as my Common Core curriculum required them to do. And so now, here it is, that in this past year, the board passed what they said a Common Core curriculum, which will not be implemented until 2016. Now, what I felt was that if we had started this Common Core curriculum, which I presented in 1987, that it would take 13 years. So the idea was that by the year 2000, every child starting at kindergarten would have gone through 13 years leading up to these Common Core and fulfilling these Common Core requirements. And by the year 2000, all students would be up to par in regard to being prepared to go to college. The district dropped the ball down along the way. And so we ended
up... It was piloted.
In 1987. And then schools started offering it. But the teachers came down to the board and they said, these students are not going to be able to, they're going to fail, you know. So the math teachers really didn't want them. And then, so the people at the district were pressured to put in some kind of course that wasn't named the Algebra 2, but it was named, they said, this will satisfy the requirement. But they found a way to get around it. And still, this new policy that they have, they say it's supposed to be implemented by 2016. This is 16 years after all of the students in the district were supposed to have gone through this program and be college eligible. So now they're still talking. This is one of the things that is so frustrating. that they are, I mean, the reforms, you have the reforms, and then somebody sabotages them. Mm-hmm. And so that reform was actually absolutely sabotaged in the district. And there were lots of articles in the paper about the Common Core curriculum that I had introduced. I got another member of the board to co-sponsor with me, so that then all we needed was one more vote, because there were only five. And so we were able to get it through. Jim Roach was the board member who met with me, and we actually were able to get that through. But anyway, that was one of the things we did. Another thing that I did too, because I told you about how they segregated the students in the classrooms, both on, when the white students came to black campuses and when the black students went to white campuses. And so what we introduced was the equity in student placement policy. And Mr. George Frey, who was my neighbor and who was an administrator in the school district and who is now, who's now dead, he was the one that really wrote, I worked with him, and he wrote the equity in student placement policy. And what that policy said was that when students are on the campus, whatever percentage of students are on the campus, for instance, if there are 20% of students on the campus, then those 20% of students are expected to be in the classrooms. For instance, if there are 80% white students and 20% black students on the campus, then in each classroom should reflect that percentage, 80-20. So therefore, they could no longer segregate the students, have 100% of black students in classrooms by themselves, or 100% of white students in classroom by themselves. So that policy was very important, too. The equity, that gave all students access to all of the classes. Now, at La Jolla High School, I went to visit, and I found out that one teacher, an English teacher, had all of the black students who came to La Jolla High School in that one class. I asked him, well, what book do you use? He said, well, I really don't use any book. And so I changed, that was one of the things that I changed. These students had to be a part of the school program, the total school program, and not just segregated within the schools.
So when he made a statement, he said, I don't use textbooks.
He doesn't really use a textbook.
So what did that help?
I don't know what he did, but the students weren't learning anything. He was just the one to take care of all the black students who came to La Jolla High School. Obviously the aim wasn't to teach them, and because they did not even use the same book that they were using in the white classrooms, the classrooms for the white students. But this is the kind of thing that was happening. Another thing was that at that time they would develop the curriculum for the elementary school students. They had teachers who would develop and write the curriculum, because their aim was to teach them maybe a phonics-based reading program, and they weren't really reading books. So I would go to the various schools, and I would find that these people had these little curriculum guides that had been produced by teachers during the summer. And no, they were stacks of them. Here's this one is teaching this and this one. But I said, well, where are the books in the classroom? So they said, there are no books. We just use this curriculum. That's what they were using.
So there was no system-wide.
It was called the Achievement Goals Program that they were using for these students, primarily black and Hispanic students. And so I took another proposal to the board that all students would have to read at least one book a month, you know, not just this achievement goals program, but they would have to actually read books. And so the librarians, so there was money for more books to go to the libraries in the schools. The librarians fell in love with me because now their books were being checked out. People would invite me to the schools to show, and the students would send up balloons for every book that they had read. There was a great big celebration at the schools because children were reading books. And they were not reading books before that in most of the schools that were, you know, that had low test scores. Because this program that they had developed was to raise the test scores of students by developing this phonics-based curriculum that would help. So that was another thing. So one of my goals was to provide, first of all, to provide access to the highest quality of education for all children. And that was through the Equity in Student Placement program and also through the Common Core curriculum. And I went and worked with a person who is now dead also, Josh Tull. He used to be principal of Oak Park School, but he had lots of wonderful ideas about the gifted program. And at that time, there were many white students who said there was no, white teachers who said there was no such thing as a black gifted child. And at that time, the gifted children were chosen by the teacher. It was a teacher that you got into the gifted program by being chosen by your teacher to be in the gifted and talented education program. There wasn't any other way that you could get in. So I went and worked with Josh Tull. I asked him to help me to develop a policy to present to the board. And we presented a policy to the board that said that, first of all students who scored on a particular test at a certain level, let's test all of those students for the gifted program. You know, before that, they weren't even tested because the teacher would not select a black child for a gifted program, no matter how high their test scores were. And so even though there are many students who are gifted who did not score well on their tests, you know, so they were C students or D students, and they might have been gifted, what I decided was, okay, well, we can at least identify some who are gifted, and then we'll work on identifying these others who are making low test scores. But there are some gifted students who are making high test scores. And so we have that information available. So let's go and select those students, all of those students who scored in the the 75th percentile on the standardized tests that they were giving to all students at certain grade levels every year. Let's select those and let's test all of them for the gifted program. As a result, many of those students who had tested and who were able to take the gifted and talented education assessment were able to be placed into the gifted program.
So before you had a really a legitimate criteria, it was like a popularity contest?
It was teacher selection. It was parent pressure on the teacher. The parents would put pressure on the teacher, and the teacher would select the people, and the teacher seldom selected a black child. In fact, one teacher at Crawford High School said there's no such thing as a gifted child. And then my own daughter, before I became a member of the school board, there was one counselor who would sign her up to go to all of the things that the gifted and talented identified children would go to. You know, the Huntington Library, they did all kinds of field trips. And so that's how she got to go. And so then that same counselor, a black counselor, signed her up to take the gifted and talented test. I guess after she started going with the others, they said, well, we demand that she take the gifted and talented test. Well, she took the GATE test, it came in two parts. They gave her the first part, And of course, she did really well on the first part, so they never called her to test her for the second part. Because they were so this was with my own child, you know. And that was before I became a member of the school board. So I knew the kinds of games mm-hmm. that they were playing in order to keep black children out of college prep classes and out of the gifted and talented education program. So as a school board member, I worked to change those policies. So I changed the gate policy so that then they started routinely testing black children who had not been routinely tested before. No black children had been routinely tested. And so by selecting that particular criteria of testing everyone who had scored at a certain level on the standardized test, then we started getting identifying more students, black students to go into the gifted program. Before that, you never saw any black students in gifted programs. And so so those were just some of the policies. My idea was to change the policies to provide access to students to the highest quality of education. Another thing that I did was, to disaggregate the test scores. Before, they would simply say, 65% of the students are doing such and such, and they're making these test scores, and so therefore the district looks good. Well, I was concerned about the 35%. I said, within that 35%, I want to know how the black students did on the test, how the white students did, how the Asian students did, how the Hispanic students did, because they weren't breaking out the test scores then. So as a result of the policy that I introduced, they started disaggregating and showing how each group was doing. And when they started showing how each group was doing, then they could see that some students were not doing well. That the white students were doing well. At first, we didn't have very many Asian students in the district. They came maybe in the mid-80s. But that way, they started actually looking at how students were doing. And another thing that we did was to look at each school. You might, right now, ever since I was on the board or introduced this to the board, they have developed a profile of each school. And I was the one who started that, too. I introduced the policy that the research and evaluation department would develop a profile of each school. I wanted to know what courses were offered at each school, what percentage of students of each racial groups were in school, what funds were at each school, so that we could see where the funds were, where the courses were, where the opportunities were for students to take the college prep courses at each school, elementary and middle school and high school. And so we started that so that we would be able to objectively look at what was happening at each school. So still, they still have that. You can go to any school and you can ask them for a profile of the school and you can look at that profile and see what's being offered at that school. You can also see the inequities. You can see courses that are needed. You can see that there are certain courses that are not offered. You can see that there are so many the higher academic courses that are offered at some schools and not as others. And so that was also an attempt to provide an equal access to a quality education at each school. So that was just some of the things that I was able to do.